Most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control indicate about 1 in 68 children are identified with autism spectrum disorder. On this week's Eastern Standard, in recognition of April as National Autism Awareness Month, we'll discuss autism, a developmental disorder that impacts many families and children right here in the Commonwealth, across the country, and around the world. We're interested in your questions, comments, and personal stories on the topic of autism. Feel free to send them now by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post on the WEKU Facebook page, send a tweet at WEKUEST, and in a little while we'll open the phones as well. That email address once again, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, it's time for Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. According to a study conducted by Rapid Intelligence, about 3.8 in 10,000 Kentuckians have been diagnosed with autism. That ranks in the lowest third in the country. I'm not sure exactly what that statistic means. Does that mean that Kentucky is high in the incidence of autism or low? But we're going to ask our guests to clarify that research we've done before the show. On today's Eastern Standard, we hope to hear your questions, your stories, and your comments about persons with autism. And we'd like to answer those questions during the program. If you write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Call us at 800-621-8890 or send an email. Once again, that email address, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. We actually won't get phone calls on the air for a little while, but feel free to get on the line, and we'll be ready to get to you a little bit later in the program. You can also send us a tweet at WEKUEST. So for our discussion today, we have three guests in the studio, and with me are Melanie Tyner-Wilson. And Melanie is a board member of the Autism Society of the Bluegrass. She is a family support specialist, works with a developmental pediatrician at the University of Kentucky, and actually the parent of a young man with autism.
Yes.
Melanie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Patty Parsons is also with us. Patty, likewise, a board member of the Autism Society of the Bluegrass and project coordinator for the Kentucky Peer Support Network Project at the Human Development Institute at the University of Kentucky. And, again, also a parent of a child with autism.
Yes, a 22-year-old son.
Thank you so much, Patty, for being here with us. And from Eastern Kentucky University, Dr. Shirley O'Brien. And Shirley is professor of occupational science and occupational therapy at EKU. She's consistently served in the American Occupational Therapy Association, state associations, and other professional groups, is published and presents on this topic of autism, and has, through her career, been an advocate for children and their families. Thank you so much for being with us, Shirley.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me just open the conversation by asking you all to define for us the autism spectrum. I understand that that's a relatively new approach to defining what we have known as autism. And who's going to jump in and give me that answer?
I'll jump in real quickly, and then you guys help me out here. Autism is a neurobiological disorder, and it involves social impairments, communication difficulties, restricted, repetitive, and stereotypical patterns of behavior. So that's the quick and dirty version of that. And what we see with individuals who have been diagnosed with autism is that they're very differentiated. So it is a continuum. There isn't a one-size-fits-all definition. There isn't a one-size-fits-all characteristic. However, some are more severe than others, and with the DSM-5 now, the way things are categorized, people with Asperger's now fall under the autism spectrum. So what we might have known before as autism and Asperger's syndromes, they're all now characterized as autism spectrum.
Are there categories into which persons with autism fall where, I mean, and I know you say there's a spectrum, but through media, we've seen presentations where, say, a child on a program might be totally reserved and operating in their own world, or that we may find persons who communicate a little differently than those who do not experience autism. I mean, you know, are there spelled out yeah, specific categories?
And very much like if you look historically, I mean, it's somebody that was diagnosed being identified as a person with autism in the 50s and 60s might have had a very narrow, very intense, like, autism and possible intellectual disabilities as well. And over the years, in the last probably 20, 30, 40 years, we've seen the definition, the diagnosis of autism become more of what we call a spectrum. So now we have kind of like a bell-shaped curve, if you will, where we have people that if they fall in the middle, and you guys jump in if I'm not doing this justice, but if we're someone that maybe would fall in the middle of the diagnostic spectrum, they have what was perceived as kind of classic autism, where they have a certain severity level, as with the DSM-5. And then you also have people that are at the higher end of the spectrum, for lack of a better way to put it, that have average or above average intelligence and have the same challenges, but maybe the way they present, they're able to carry on a conversation, able to navigate through school situations, programs, things like that.
So virtually imperceptible to many of us who would not be attuned to?
I don't know that I'm the right person to be able to define that, but possibly. And then if you go to the other end of the spectrum, you'll have someone that has significant
impact
of the disability. Thanks, Patty. And so very, very severe, and having lots of behavioral, limited language. I mean,
and that's where media will portray, for instance, a child, because it's extreme and clearly visible and obvious and dramatic, I would imagine.
I think the important thing, and probably as you talk with us today, you'll find out that if you meet one child or one person with autism, you don't know that whole spectrum. You know that individual. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting diagnosis. For me, it's just been so interesting being on the journey with my son and meeting people like Patty's sons and folks that I've met through Dr. O'Hare's coursework and classes that she's been involved with. They're so diverse that we're a hard... We're a hard group to kind of capture in one definition.
Well, Patty Parsons, let's talk about the fact that, again, we tend to have the stereotype thinking in terms of autistic children. Talk about the fact that persons with autism, I guess, are at all age levels and ranges in our society, that because just as anyone else, huh?
Yeah, that's right, John. You know, a lot of people kind of have this misconception that autism is all about children. But as Melly and I know so well, the children grow up and they become adults with autism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can present a lot of challenges for families because, you know, when you're in school, you're mandated to receive a free, appropriate public education and you have access to a lot of services. But once children age out of school and become young adults, it's very hard for families. There's referred to as falling off the cliff of services sometimes.
As parents yourselves, and again with young men in their young 20s, it wasn't all that long ago that your sons were born. How does autism get diagnosed? When did you all, for instance, and when does the average, if there is such a thing, average parent of a person with autism know that their child experiences autism?
Well, you know, it can be different depending on the severity level. Typically, if a person is more significantly impacted by autism, they will probably be diagnosed much earlier.
Yeah.
And there's a certain subset of children who have regression that's very sudden and very noticeable. For my son, he had some challenging behaviors when he was younger, and he had difficulties with speech. But we actually did not get the diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder until he was almost 4 years old. So that's a challenge because, of course, as probably a lot of people know, early intervention is very important with autism.
Melanie?
Actually, my experience was a similar but a little bit different. Our son was diagnosed or identified much earlier. At 18 months, we went to a well child checkup with our pediatrician, and he didn't have the classic the number of words or different kinds of things. And despite the fact that both my husband are quote unquote educated with degrees and whatnot, neither of us really knew anything about early childhood development. And so we bought the book, you know, What to Expect When You're Expecting. And I read a chapter ahead every month. And then I read What to Expect the First Year of Life and the Second Year of Life. And only because I began to be aware that at a certain point in his development that there should be a certain number of words or, you know, development of having this desire to be engaged with me as a mom. It's called reciprocity or joint attention. Those things were totally absent. And so I was able to kind of share some of those concerns in not a very educated way with our pediatrician, just saying, he's just not doing things. He very much keeps to himself. And so it was through that we began to move at 18 months to begin to move through the process of ruling out possible things that could be wrong. We had a hearing assessment called the Bear test that kind of ruled out if the hearing impairment was maybe a reason why he wasn't speaking. And then we began to have different kinds of evaluations done. And eventually we got the diagnosis of autism, but it really was kind of a journey. We had to fight for it, to be real honest.
What happens then? once the diagnosis comes along,
life only just begins.
Yeah.
I suspect.
Yeah, I can tell you what happened for me. And actually, at the time my son was diagnosed, there was a category of autism called PDD-NOS, mm-hmm. pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is maybe considered a slightly better diagnosis, for lack of a better word, because it's maybe less severe. They basically said, well, you know, your son doesn't have full-blown autism, but here's some resources about autism. This was before the internet, you know.
Yeah.
They gave us some printed material, but you're pretty much on your own after that. You know, there's no, if you have diabetes, there's a protocol, but there's not a really clearly defined protocol. Parents have to find out about the different resources themselves and seek out other parents. And that's kind of how it was for us.
Do we know what causes autism? What is it? Is it a brain disorder? Is there something organically that has gone wrong?
They are getting closer and closer. There's lots of research right now that's going on where they're trying to find out, is it an environmental? Is it a chromosomal kind of genetic kind of influence? And I think as time goes on, that we're going to get closer and closer to that, to understanding what it truly is.
We're going to come back and learn more, and there's so much to learn about autism. And one of the things I'd like to ask both Shirley O'Brien and actually Melanie Tyler Wilson and Patty Parsons to tell me about the lives of your sons since they have been diagnosed with autism. This is Eastern Standard. We're talking autism. It's Autism Awareness Month. Your questions, your comments, your personal stories are welcome. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Pick up the phone and give us a call, 800-621-8890. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We're talking autism on this week's program. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com is our email address. You're welcome to call in and be part of the program, 800-621-8890. I understand there is at least one call on the line, and Mike from Berea, we will get to you in just a few minutes. There are certain things we should get out of the way, some of this information, before we turn to our listeners, but we certainly want to involve our listeners in this conversation. Your questions, your comments, your personal stories of family members or those you've known who have autism, the disorder or the condition of autism. 800-621-8890. 8890. And I cut you all off talking with Melanie and Patty here, talking about their causes and what do we know about why there is autism.
I think that
I was going to just
Shirley.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and say that we really the science is really developing, and that's the exciting part right now, especially the genetic piece of it. For many years, mothers were made to feel really bad about having a child with autism.
That like was, they did something wrong?
Yeah, they did something wrong. And that, you know, and that is totally refutable, as along with the vaccine issues that we have. All of those studies were recalled, but yet by public – or most of them were recalled, but yet by public opinion, people are still looking at it. Yeah. And so I think we have to explore that idea of – what is in vaccines further? We need more scientific data on it. We just can't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
It's Dr. Shirley O'Brien of Eastern Kentucky University. Patty Parsons, you look like you're reacting to what Shirley has to say here.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, there's a lot of controversy and a lot of questions about what really does cause autism. And I think the truth is that there are a number of causes, and that's pretty well accepted. There is a lot of research on the genetics, but a lot of people in the autism community think that there's got to be something environmental that's triggering all these cases, because there cannot be a genetic epidemic. And I think we're looking at a pretty, you know, there's one in 68 children that will be diagnosed with autism. That's the latest statistics. And that's gone up from about one in 500 when our sons were diagnosed. So that is a huge increase.
And that's not just a matter of better means of diagnosis awareness.
They've been talking about better diagnosis for at least the last 10 or 15 years. And every 2 years they do these studies to say what the prevalence level is. And, you know, 2 years ago it was 1 in 88. That's a huge increase, and I don't think it can all be accounted for by better diagnosis.
Historically, how long have we known about
autism? I mean, it's
autism?
Only been a condition that was recognized in the 40s, in the 1940s. So, and back then it was, you know, considered extremely rare, 1 in 10,000.
And Dr. Avi Klim has been doing some research internationally with infants, 7 to 9 month old infants, looking at where their visual gaze is going. And what we find is people with autism typically focus on the mouth. And so what we're we focus on as we're talking, we all make eye contact. So when you look at, there's so much going on with our mouths moving, as my mouth is moving right now, you could see where the disorganization would come from. And he is perfecting some of these at the Ohio Low Incidence Conference. It's called OCaliCon. This past November, he presented his research, and that is an excellent resource for parents and professionals to attend.
That is. That's a great conference.
Let's go ahead and invite Mike into our conversation, because he took the effort to call in early in the program. Mike from Berea, go right ahead with your question or your comment, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I just wanted to first say this is so wonderful that you are having this discussion. I've worked in treatment of spectrum individuals for 7 years in various capacities. I have over 10,000 hours of field observation, and I'm currently taking a break from going to school for neuroscience because this problem keeps me up at night. Why are we seeing the rates of autism that we do now? And my opinion on it, after doing this research and working in this field, is that this is a disorder that has always been here, and I think it may be that these individuals are various compositions of modern human neurotypes with the modern equipment, the speech receiving and projecting, as well as the ability to read microbody language and the desire to want to engage socially. I think that we see an individual who has some older parts of our brains as humans, and then some new parts to varying degrees, which is where our spectrum or the bell curve, as one of your panel members spoke about, comes in. And I'm not convinced that there is an environmental component, and I'm not denying it either. But the thing I've seen working with these individuals, when I meet the parents, often the parents have some of these traits, not as severe, But they have some of these markers, and then they had a baby, and some of these were recessive, and you put those two genomes together, and if you've distilled something out of that, if there are already markers there, you're going to get a more severe, I don't like to use that term, but a more severe form of this. But I want to be very clear and say, you know, they, like they said earlier, that mothers used to be blamed for this. Mm-hmm. That they were somehow cold.
Well, Mike,
somehow they didn't nurture.
Stay on the line, Mike, because Melanie here is reacting to you visually, which you can't see. Well, you stay on the line, and let's hear from Melanie what she has to say in reaction.
I'm having reciprocity and joint attention with you, Mike, even though I can't see you. You're right on target, because I think what we're going to find is, like, if you got to know my husband and myself, I probably do have traits that come out, and we get our gene pools together. And what I've learned, just being a humble parent kind of on the journey and reading some of the research, is that there probably are many kinds of autism. There are autisms, you know, plural, and that's why we all present in our own individual and unique way. But if you have two, you know, gene pools that combine and create another being, and then for whatever reason there is some kind of exposure to something, I think that's why you might see some people have a very intense response and some people have non-response at all. But what's challenging about this is that the timing of when some of the different things are introduced, you know, into a small human being's body. And if you have someone that is vulnerable, quote unquote, and has difficulty dealing with some of those different environmental toxins, and it could be everything from things in the water to the air that we breathe to the, you know, the food that we eat. You know, all those things can influence, you know, how these oh, a baby.
That's my 12-month-old son.
Oh, beautiful.
Well, Mike, let me ask you this before we let you go. Do you think we all have a little autism in us? I mean, it's part of the human condition, but it's just expressed more extremely in some persons?
That is an incredibly apt question. And, you know, the way I like to set this up, and this at the risk of sounding chauvinistic or sexist, I'm just going to preface that. This is the, you know, men and women are neurologically different, and that's how I'm setting this up. So before I say anything, so if you set the bar for spectrum disorder with just a male, with an average number of male brains, if that's how you set the bar, women hardly wouldn't qualify. You would have to be pretty severely down the spectrum for most women to qualify. But if you did the opposite, if you set the spectrum by what we, you know, what the neurology of the average female brain, the number of men that would qualify would go up greatly. And I have come to look at the male and female brains. If you were going to talk spectrum disorder, the autistic brain is the super male brain, all, you know, and eventually you go to a spectrum on that side where it's non-functioning. But the other side, and the side we don't see, and this is what I saw with my work with children, the side we don't see as many numbers of the females that are experiencing hyper-feminine brains because they don't tend to have the behavioral issues.
Well, yep. If I could jump in, there just was some new research coming out where they're starting to look more closely at women, and your point's well taken in that if we use a certain criteria in a way that we evaluate, you know, a foundational kind of thing, then there have been many females that have not been found, quote unquote, until they're much older, and it's because frequently women, and also sounds sexist saying this, but women have oftentimes more social ability,
yes,
that, and more of our behaviors, if we are autistic, are more nuanced. And so until we get assessment tools that can tease that tease that information out, we don't capture some of the folks that have just as involved impairment, but that's harder to pull that information out.
Let me just say we're going to let Mike go because he's opened up a number of issues here that we can toss around here for a little while. Thank you so much, and all the best with that little one, Mike. Yeah. Thanks for calling in. Let me mention the phone number also, 800-621-8890, if you'd like to participate in this week's Eastern Standard as we talk about autism. You can also send an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. That number again, 800-621-8890. Shirley O'Brien wants to jump in here.
I'm really glad Mike raised that issue because many of the women who have autism or who have been diagnosed or diagnosed during adolescence and present typically with mental health issues, OCD. They have anxiety disorders. The research is also showing this shows up now as college freshmen, college sophomores.
Right. That's very true.
So I appreciate what he was trying to say.
And there is also the fact that autism is diagnosed, about four times more frequently in boys than in girls. Mm-hmm. So that's going to play into part of it.
Let's talk, as I had mentioned earlier, a long time ago, actually, about the life of your children, Melanie Tyner Wilson and Patty Parsons, parents of young adults, 21, 22, did you say?
22.
They're both 22. Both 22. Mm-hmm. Melanie, what is your son's life like? Does he go to school? Does he work? How is autism how has it modified his life from that of what it might have been had he not had autism?
Well, my son, I'm very honored to be his mother. One thing, and he's an amazing young man. My son did not have the opportunity to graduate with a diploma from high school. He was what they call the alternate assessment. So he stayed in school until he was 21, and so then basically he aged out. After during high school, he had an opportunity to be involved in an agricultural learning center that Fayette County Schools, it's called Locust Trace. It's a wonderful, wonderful place where he began to learn about horses and animals and care for, on a farm experience. And it was really a great opportunity because it was combining an interest that he had naturally, with something that we could maybe tweak and help to shape into possible employment down the road. But once the school bus stops picking your child up, you have to figure out how to fill 8 hours a day or 24 hours a day, if you will. And what we very much wanted to have our son have an opportunity is to be a part of the community, to be employed, to do whatever a non-autistic person would do. So we had to work very hard to find individuals that could be a part of his life, to have meaningful experiences in his day, and then finding employment was an incredible challenge, but we actually we're at the point now where we have found a small part-time job for him at the university, and just very, very blessed to have that. And he's beginning to learn those skills about being a working member of society.
And this is Jay.
This is Jay.
And he's a person that most of us would probably recognize as having expression of the autism.
Yeah, Jay has a combination of autism and an intellectual disability. And so he's a very handsome young man, if I could say so myself. But he's warm, he's friendly, he has difficulty communicating, but he can make his needs and wants known. If he likes you as a person, you will know that, and he's just a really good man, I think.
Patty Parsons, let's talk about your son.
Well, I have a wonderful son named Jake, and he, this is a struggle that all families face, because when your child is in school, they have a guarantee of what they call a free appropriate public education, and that's going to include, some special education services, some therapies, all kinds of services that they basically have a right to. Once you're out of public school, it's not considered a right anymore. There are programs available that we have availed ourselves of. And it's, you know, it's hard because, there, like Melanie said, there's a lot of hours to fill up. And when both parents are working, which we are, you have to get some, you know, you have to make arrangements. So what Jake does, he works only a half a day a week at a retail store. And, you know, I tried to get some more hours, but they say he's not really ready for that yet. He takes guitar lessons once a week. He participates in adult fitness through Parks and Rec's therapeutic recreation program. He goes another half day a week at a job training program. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time he is working with community living support workers, going out in the community and doing things. So, you know, I'm always looking at how can this be better. One thing we're doing right now is we're doing job exploration to find maybe a more fitting job. And like Jake loves animals, especially dogs. So we're exploring, you know, him being a pet walker or washing dogs, you know, different things like that.
Is marriage, relationships, a family for your sons going to be an option? I hope that's not too personal.
Oh, no, that's a great question. And I would love to see my son find somebody in his life that he wants to have a relationship like I've had the honor of having with my own husband. And so we haven't got to that place yet, but I hope it comes, because I think every human being wants to have love in their lives, someone that they can develop a deep and committed relationship to. So my hope would be that he has that in his lifetime.
And I think one of the things that is a misnomer is that everyone needs to get married by the time they're in their early 20s. And allowing people just the time through their lifespan. Yeah. You know, autism is not just a condition that's going to go away. So it's learning about yourself, that self-regulation, what your needs are going to be and what transitions you'll need, so that as we move forward, that, you know, it may happen when they're 40.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of people now that don't get married till they're 40. So,
this is Eastern Standard. We're talking about autism. It's Autism Awareness Month. We are due, hard to believe, but it's time for another break. And we are going to invite listeners to participate in the conversation. Monica from Lexington is on the line. You're welcome to send us an email, WEKU Eastern Standard@gmail.com. If you're on Twitter, we've won. Encourage you to follow us at WEKUEST. And we understand you don't necessarily have to follow to send a direct message anymore. Something's changed there. But feel free to send us a direct message at WEKUEST with your question or comment that can be made in 140 characters. Post on the WEKU Facebook page even after the program if you're listening to a repeat of the program. Or pick up the phone and be part of our conversation, 800-621-8890. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We are having a fascinating conversation about autism spectrum disorder. I'm John Hingsbergen. Guests with me in the studio are Melanie Tyner-Wilson and Patty Parsons. Both of them are board members of the Autism Society of the Bluegrass. Dr. Shirley O'Brien, professor of occupational science and occupational therapy at Eastern Kentucky University. You are welcome to get on the line to be part of our conversation, 800-621-8890, or send an email, WEKU Eastern Standard@gmail.com. And Melanie and Patty are both parents of young men with autism, both 22 years old. Jay is Melanie's son. Jake is Patty's son. And one more question about their personal lives and your families is what happens, ladies, when you and their dads are no longer around? What happens and this is in general, I'm sure, for persons with autism, will they be able to live in society independently?
There's an amazing statement that I saw the other day that says a parent's dream is that they would live one day longer than their child with a disability, any disability, meaning that I can be in his life forever and ever. And the reality is that probably is not true. And that's something that keeps many of us awake at night in terms of basically my other full-time job has been to figure out how to plan and put together a lot, you know, preparation for our son so that when we're gone, there's resources, there's a place to live, there's people that will be in his life, there'll be meaningful employment, there'll be a community that welcomes him. You know, all of that is stuff that we all, as mothers and fathers, spend a boatload of time trying to figure out how to put in place right now so that when, as we become senile and old and older, you know, that all those things will be in place so that our children, our loved ones, can live a meaningful life.
Well, and some of the preparations that we've taken, I feel like we've got a long way to go, so hopefully we'll live a few more years.
Yeah.
You know, we have a special needs trust for our son. There's no real money in it, but we have a life insurance policy where when the second one of us dies, he will receive some money to go into his trust, and that'll help provide for him. But I think that the more important thing is, like Melanie said, to get them involved in the community, preferably with, you know, paid employment, more than a half a day a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is an appropriate time to talk about this, but I think that the preparations that parents and schools can make when children are in the transition age, say high school age, middle school, high school, can have such an impact on their lives. There's actually a lot of research on that, and one of them is that the best predictor of paid employment and adulthood is paid employment in high school.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wish I would have known that statistic when my son was in high school. I think, you know, I would have done things a lot differently. And likewise, you know, I'm the project coordinator for the Kentucky Peer Support Network project. And what our project tries to do is to help schools facilitate relationships and increase inclusive activities between students with and without disabilities. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times our kids are in separate classrooms, or even if they're included in the classroom, they may be at the back of the classroom with an aide doing completely different things. And I think it's very important that students with autism and all disabilities be included in the life of the school, which is something my son really did not get a chance to do.
We're going to shift gears and talk about community support and what's out there for families and persons with autism. Let me get another caller or two on the air before we do that. And Monica from Lexington has been on the line for a while, kind of bringing us back to the issue of the potential causes of autism. And we don't want to get too bogged down in that area because no matter what, it's here. So we want to deal with that reality. But Monica, certainly go ahead and offer your comment that you called in to share with us.
Well, they I just read an article in a local Lexington Health magazine, and they were talking about the number of toxins everywhere in the air we breathe, our homes, what we clean with, the pesticides in our food and so forth. And it says since World War II, we've introduced over 80,000 chemicals into commerce in our country, and we have something like 1,000 more every year. And the last time Congress passed, according to this article, any federal laws on cosmetics and personal care industry chemicals was 1938, and they banned 11 chemicals, and that was 77 years ago. And right now, the European Union has banned over 1,400 ingredients, and they are very, very tough on making sure that what chemicals come out for, you know, body use or pesticides or whatever are regulated. And right now, people are fighting regulation, and it seems as though, you know, it's becoming less and less. And the other question I had was, or maybe you covered this. Do you have statistics with comparing percentage-wise our incidence of autism versus other countries?
Versus other countries, okay. Certainly an explosion in this country. We know that.
Yeah.
I don't really know that, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I hear some autism organizations say that there's not a variation, but I have not seen any statistics to back that up. But
Monica,
I do share your concerns about the environmental exposures. And, you know, another thing that I've heard recently is, you know, genetically modified foods started in the 90s, and that's when we saw this big explosion. And I do share a lot of your concerns about the toxins. I've often said, I mean, I've said for years that I think our kids are kind of the canaries in the coal mine. You know, I think the chemical exposure is bad for all of us, but perhaps if you have a predisposition to be more impacted by that, that may be the cause of some of the increase in autism we're seeing.
That's a really great point. And going back to your question about internationally, I don't know, not off the top of my head. Yeah. I think that would be a really good piece to add in.
Yeah.
And we could add a link to at the end.
Let me get one more caller on the air right now, and we may or may not get to Roseanne from Scott County, but let's talk to Sean from Lexington. Sean, thank you for calling Eastern Standard. You are on the air.
Hi. My question is, given that the spectrum is now so broad to include just about a kid with any odd behavior, has that had a consequence in terms of research and treatment? My mom and my sister are both therapists, and they've kind of described that just about every kid they run into has been diagnosed by someone as being autistic.
I think Patty disagrees with you.
Go ahead with your question.
But it is a problem for insurance companies and researchers. Is anybody, you know, addressing this issue kind of diagnosis and DSM creep, because it has had research consequences. So thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thank you so much for calling, Sean.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things Sean is asking us is how well do you set up your inclusion criteria in studies? And that's where I think some of the DSM creep has helped us, because it's caused us as researchers to be more specific. Mm-hmm. And you have to qualify everyone who is in your study, along with understanding that there are personalities, there are different sensory systems, mm-hmm. And the way we present. So you have to then add that into your demographics. So,
and again, let's return to society and community support. And of course, again, Melanie Tyner Wilson and Patty Parsons are both involved with the Autism Society of the Bluegrass. Let's talk about what you all do there. What is the purpose of the Autism Society?
Well, we're mainly a support for families, although we do provide training and support for professionals and other people that are impacted by autism. We have meetings every month on the last Monday of the month at from 6:30 to 8:30 at the St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Lexington. And if you want to find out more about that, our website is asbg.org.
And participants in those meetings would be families, parents?
And professionals come sometimes, yeah. Support people that work directly with people with autism. But a lot of it is family-oriented. And it's been a wonderful resource for me. I mean, Melanie's one of my best friends, and we wouldn't have known each other otherwise. It's kind of like the club you'd ever want to be a part of, but at least there's some great people in the club.
They really are. It's a great org. It really is a great. It's probably, if not the oldest, it's one of the oldest of Autism Society of America chapters in our state. I think it's been around for 25 years, and it's just. What's nice about it is that everybody's a volunteer. And we support one another. We sometimes, when you're wandering through this world, you know, it's not, you feel very isolated, and it's nice to connect with somebody that maybe is just a little bit further down the road that you can talk with and just be, to get a better understanding. And I think that our group has really met that need. And also we put our meetings on YouTube, which is really cool. If you can't come to a meeting, you can watch it on YouTube and still get the information.
Search it up as what? Autism Society of the Bluegrass?
Yeah.
Autism Bluegrass,
and,
perhaps, something like that.
And we have a very involved listserv where we have people post questions and information about upcoming events and some very thoughtful and sensitive responses from people that are, you know, in our group, on the board, members, longtime members, but really caring people. You know, people, like if someone's new to the group, they might say, where's a good place? Who's a good dentist? Who's a good doctor? Who's a good pediatrician? You know, I'm trying to find a place that would help me to be able to get my child's hair cut. Who's a good barber, you know, so it's really great kind of boots on the ground kind of support.
And that's a good example of people with autism have sensory needs.
Yeah.
And not everybody does, can really provide those kind of services in both medical fields, in the community, in our service industry. So knowing where to go is important. I was going to ask Melanie, isn't there a walk coming up this fall?
By the way, I think you're right. Patty, can you share some information about the upcoming walk for the Autism Society
sounds like
of the
a setup
Bluegrass?
To me. Go right ahead, Patty.
Yes, we have a great time at our Autism Walk. It's partially a fundraiser, but it's also a great chance for families just to have a good time. And the last couple of years, and including this year, it's been at the Lexington Legends Ballpark in Lexington. It's called Whitaker Bank Ballpark. The date this year is Sunday, September 27th in the afternoon, and you can find out more about that at our website, asbg.org. But we would love to have you put together a team and come out and walk with us.
ASBG.org. We'll mention that web address again. And, of course, listeners can go to weku.fm for information about this show and to listen to it after the fact and download it and share it.
Thanks.
And we'll post what resources we have available here. Okay, we're taping live our broadcast on April 30th. We've waited to the last minute of the month of April to talk about Autism Awareness Month being April. Why? What does the public need to know in these last few minutes of our program and these last few hours of April as far as autism awareness? Why do we need autism awareness?
Well, and I think it's acceptance, too, because I think autism is here. The incidence rate has grown. There's many people in our community. In our lives that have autism, and I think that it's important just to be able to appreciate and celebrate and understand the unique abilities and strengths and challenges that this population brings to the table,
and also the dignity that these individuals should receive, and we should all demonstrate. I would hope that we would all begin to look in our own communities of how can we incorporate people who may be a little bit different.
Yeah.
What can we do to support everyone? Because every one of us are different.
Yeah.
What's needed? I mean, you know, the whole movement of the Americans with Disabilities Act a number of years ago provided ramps for people who needed to get access to places and crosswalks that have audible alerts on them and so forth. And we've got closed captioning available for persons with hearing disabilities. What's needed for persons with autism and their families that is not in place right now?
Well, you know, I would like to see people with autism more engaged in their communities. And, you know, I think that starts in the school years.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the more involvement they can have during their school years, the more likely they are to be involved as adults.
Are the schools doing a good job right now? Is there more needed in the schools?
Some of them are doing a really good job. I think some schools need a lot of help. And if I can mention the project I work on again, the Peer Support Network Project.
Sure.
We're in the pilot site stage right now. We've had about 10 pilot schools around the state that have received this training. We're gathering data to see what works and what is a problem, what needs to be improved. But we're actually offering a series of trainings this summer in July. Most of them are in July. One of them's in August. There's going to be 6 trainings around the state. For people in this area, the one in Lexington is going to be July 15th on a Wednesday, and there's going to be one in Corbin on Monday, July 20th. And you can find out more about that on our website at kypeersupport.org. I would love to talk to anybody more about it. I think you'll be posting our information on your website.
Absolutely.
You can email me.
Are there public policy issues or legislative issues and things?
Oh, yes. Money.
Everybody needs money.
I think that's the big, because there was a bill that was passed federally that had had its title changed. I think it's now called the Autism Cares Act. And the idea is that when the bill passed through the legislature, that there it was more focused on research, and there was an outcry from families and adults saying, "This yes, research is wonderful and it's important, but what they really wanted to make sure is that we had funding available that went very directly to the individual, because what we're seeing in our state and other states is there are waivers that are available to people, but they're limited in terms of the numbers that they can, you know, the numbers of people they can provide. And if you're not fortunate enough to receive something like that and you're traveling through life, you have very limited options, like Patty was talking about earlier, after you leave high school. And so having a funding source that people can really be able to access meaningful and appropriate services, not putting people in day programs, you know, but really meaningful lives.
That's it. And the other thing in terms of preparing professionals, Eastern Kentucky University has an autism certificate program. It's 18 credit hours at the graduate level. We take psychology students, communication disorders, occupational therapy, and special nurses. Educators are involved in it. And we're one of the only autism certificate programs that has a sensory processing focus in it, which is very unique. I encourage you, we'll have that on the website also.
Well, we are hoping that our program has done a little bit to assist with autism awareness, even though it's the very last hour or days of day and hours of Autism Awareness Month. Thank you so much, Dr. Shirley O'Brien, Patty Parsons, Melanie Tyner-Wilson. Again, our program will be on board on our website at weku.fm. Links and resources will be posted there once we get them in place later this afternoon on Thursday afternoon. The show repeats on Sunday evening as well. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much.
And
this was fun.
Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Our program is produced by WEKU at Eastern Kentucky University. Associate producers are Richard Turner and Logan Riley. Logan did the production work putting this show together. We are interested in your comments and suggestions for Eastern Standard at any time. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Julie Tennell has been on the phones. Our technical director for the program is WEKU Operations Coordinator Brian Bartlett. I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for being part of today's Eastern Standard.